This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you probably know, we built the Scotland Outdoors Podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And this is the programme where we finally find out the answer to the question, what is apple leather?
Now, that is not this week's mystery sound, but we recorded that in the car park here in Beechgrove in Aberdeen just 10 minutes ago because we knew full well that if we waited till the red light went on, it would shut up, which it has. It just goes to show. Good morning, I'm Mark Stevens, standing right beside me here at the fire in BBC Aberdeen. Linda Sinclair, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Delighted to be back here in this daylight this time around. Last time in October, it was dark and it was a wee bit dreich, but lovely to be here. What are you up to today, folks? Get in touch and tell us your plans. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or text 80295. Your standard network message rate applies. Serenaded by that woodpecker, isn't that lovely? You can call us as well on 0808 592 95 00. Alex is here to take your calls. And of course, we have a mystery sound this morning.
We do have one, proper one.
Take a listen to this.
Was that it then?
It was, well, yeah, I didn't get it. It was 50-50 in the office yesterday with the guesses on that one. Uh-huh. If you've any idea what the mystery sound is, get in touch. Here we go again. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or text 80295. Your standard network message rate applies. You can call us as well. 0808 592 95 00. Alex is here to take your calls.
Okay, so clearly it is an electronic device capturing another sound and putting it into an audible rate. I don't know.
You could be right. You could be onto something.
You reckon?
Beats me. Now, around 30 years ago, a network of paths was established in and around Pitlochry, so visitors could easily walk to some of the local beauty spots. Now, in the subsequent years, some of these routes have fallen into disrepair, and with the council, like many across Scotland, unable to find the money to fix the paths, a group of volunteers has stepped into the breach.
Yeah, something called the Pitlochry Path Group meets once a fortnight all year to carry out essential repairs, and you went to meet them at the Garry Bridge near Pitlochry.
We'll go and get these timber first.
All right.
Yeah. Right, so it's a plan now.
So I've joined the volunteers here on this beautiful tree-lined path just above the River Garry. Chris Allen, now you're in charge of this working group today. Can you explain exactly what is it you're doing right now?
We're taking a piece of fallen timber, an older trunk, and we're edging the path. We're putting it alongside the path and then using iron spikes to hold it in place, which will allow us to build up the surface of the path. As you can see, it's sloping way down to the river right now, very sharply down to the river. So obviously, if we built up the path without putting some kind of edging in, it would just slump back to the down to the river again.
Okay.
So this edging will stop the path from sloping in the way it's doing at the moment and allow us to put a flat surface, which will be much safer for walkers and cyclists and whoever.
And you've managed to find this bit of wood just discarded, so you're sort of been green about this, recycling things.
Yeah, and in fact, the plank that's underneath that bit of wood, Keith found floating down the river, I think. that's also recycled timber. So, yeah, we're being very green. We're reusing and recycling.
This looks like quite a big, hard task, though. I've just been watching the guys with their mattock. That's the word, a new word that I've learned today, mattock, to like try and cut
these roots.
That's a hard job,
the
that.
Tree roots on the path are a real big problem there. As the path packs down, the tree roots come out the ground, or come proud of the ground, of the path, and they present really serious trip hazards to people. And they're also part of the reason the path starts to get narrower. People don't want to walk on them, so they sort of walk in a shorter and shorter section, so you end up with the path packing down, so the path gets narrower as well as sloping, which obviously makes it very dangerous. Most of the time when we're digging this out of the path, we find that the tree roots are dead, but they're quite challenging to get out. A lot of work.
How do you know what you're doing? I mean, I don't want to be patronising you, but how do you know how to go about this? How do you know where to start?
Well, you can see, I mean, it's not just here, you can see they've done this same technique on other parts of the path long before we got here. This is how the surface of the path was built up. These pegs that are, you can see these wooden pegs, they were there holding tree trunks in the past, and the tree trunks have rotted away. So we're really just replacing what was there in the past. But as to, you know, generally we use our common sense. We've got a lot of people in the path group, as I say, who's experienced, you know, they're civil engineers and so on. And there's a lot of information, you know, online. And we've even had path training groups. When we were doing the Ben Verachie path, we employed a contractor. It was too big a task for us. So working with Perth and Kinross Countryside Trust, they helped us raise a bunch of money, more than £200,000, to improve that path and repair it because it got into a very bad condition. And those contractors, as part of their, as well as redoing the path, they gave us training.
Great, don't want to hold you back or get in your road. So I'm joined by Kath Marshall, who's the secretary of the Pitlochry Path Group. Tell me about the Pitlochry Path Group. When did it start?
Right, well, it's been going for about 11 years now, 11 years past. And it formed basically as a result of, you know, there's a network of paths around Pitlochry, which the council had set up way back in 96, but they weren't able to maintain them. So that became apparent. So a few of us got together. So we became the Pitlochry Path Group.
Where do you get the money from, though? Because this must take quite a bit of money, you know, the tools that you've got to do this.
We do get some money from the council, not a lot, but some. Other than that, we have to apply for grants, or local organisations help us out, either with cash or in kind sometimes. So we just have to go around with the begging bowl and hopefully they'll take pity on us. But although, you know, although all our labour's free, the stuff that we work with sometimes, for example, if we're actually upgrading a path, you need, you know, base layers, you know, stone, type one we call it, sand, wind dust, that sort of stuff, edging, wooden edging, you know, that costs money. So we need to raise enough money to be sure we can pay for that before we embark on a new project. But today's didn't cost us anything, just a bit of sweat.
Yeah. And what's your name?
Andrew Holmes. We're primarily retired people, so you pace yourself, but we get a lot done, and we can see the difference, and people do appreciate it. We get people emailing or just even stopping and saying, "You're doing a grand job, folks," and thank you.
But the majority of you are retired and are a bit older, and you could argue are maybe not as fit to do this as the younger generation, so why should you be breaking your back to do it?
Well, first of all, because we are retired, we've got the time to do it. Secondly, and I think a lot of us feel this way, is that doing things like this ensures that we keep going.
Right, OK. What do you personally get out of it then?
Oh, I get out of it, I think, a feeling of having contributed, a feeling of, you know, feeling good after exercise, but I use these paths a lot myself, and it's very satisfying to come along on something that you worked on a year, 2 years now, 5, 6, 10 years ago even, and thinking, this is good, and if we hadn't done this, it would be in a sorry state.
The group have also been involved in a small project to prevent beavers further downstream from here from felling too many trees. Now, Colin Somerville, you've been involved with that project, haven't you? Can you tell me a bit more about it?
We're putting this, as recommended by the Beavers Trust, is it's a weld mesh. It's a 2-inch weld mesh, and we put it so it's a metre up in the tree. Obviously, keep it away from the tree so you're not taking bark off it and that. And then peg them down because they can lift. Apparently, they can lift the cage up. So the idea is to hold it in position. And it's almost like a burglar alarm in your house. It's not going to guarantee you the burglar's not going to go, but it's trying to move them on somewhere else.
And is there any evidence to suggest that's working then, that's doing its job?
We've only been doing it since February. So any we've put in, there's no beaver activity on these trees. We're protected, but there's still beaver activity on the trees round about.
So which trees are you doing that to? The older trees?
Yeah, or what the beaver guy says, protect your specimen trees. So I'm not a tree expert. It's maybe a weeping willow. And he said, I would protect that one. I'll have that down in a night. And some of the maturer trees, and also ones that may, if the beaver hits them, they'll damage property. So I've been trying to, that's, if you like, there's a decision process. We've probably not got it right, but that's the decision. Is can it damage? Is it going to fall in the path? Is it worth protecting? And I'm sure we'll learn as we go and think, well, maybe we should have protected that tree as well.
And this is right beside housing, isn't it? I'm quite surprised that the beavers are so brazen.
Well, you probably see the one that walks up the Westmoreland Road, you know, and they walk in front of cars, they've no road sense, right. You know, and the size of the things, you know. So, hey-ho.
Brazen beavers, they're a scourge, I tell you. Colin Somerville and other members of the Pitlochry Paths group there.
Yes, and if you want to read more about their work, I've written an article for the BBC Scotland website and there's some great pictures there showing what they're doing. Unfortunately, we couldn't feature in that article a video that Chloe Campbell, who's from Ballylouig, I think I'm right in saying, who videoed this beaver walking up Bonnet Hill Road in Pitlochry, brazen as anything. Her and her husband were in the car, they were filming this beaver in the dark. And they thought,
oh, it was in the dark.
And they reversed the car because they thought the beaver's going to come towards them. And the beaver started coming towards them. They were too frightened to get out of the car.
Where are you going?
Beaver doesn't have road sense.
No, that's true. But if you wonder what on earth it's doing walking up the road. I've said this before, but it was one years ago, escaped from a wildlife park in Loch Lomond and it crossed the Clyde and ended up in a back street in Greenock. I mean, the poor animal must have been terrified.
Shocked.
Yeah. Couldn't find the kebab shop anywhere. And you started off that piece saying that they were laying a log of alder, sometimes known as Scots mahogany, right? Because it likes growing in wet conditions, etc. And if you cut it open, it's really quite a dark red timber, you know, it's there. But I think I'm correct in saying that when they built the original Cranog Centre, they used alder logs. And they were trying to figure out how on earth do you actually get this into, you know, the lake bed, the loch bed, essentially. And they literally just sharpened one end, plonked it there, and then they lashed a cross piece to it, and they just went side by side. You know, they went left, right, left, right, left, and it drills itself down into the mud. But, and this is the clever thing, you put it in upside down, because all the sort of capillaries within the log are designed to take water from the roots up to the top, but not the other way down.
Right. I didn't realise logs had capillaries.
Why?
Every day is how do you a
get
school
the,
day.
How do you get the sap up otherwise?
Well, yeah, of course.
Anyway.
Fascinating stuff.
Sometimes we find ourselves just in the right place at the right time, which happened to me earlier this week. I was waiting to record an interview in Dunbar Harbour, and suddenly, just, you know, what was there in terms of sound just jumped straight out of me.
This is lazy man's bird watching. I'm standing about less than 10 feet away from a kittiwake colony. I'm down in Dunbar Harbour, and there's the ruins of Dunbar Castle there. Now, it's got a long and interesting history. This used to be the Kingdom of Northumbria, and then the Picts came along, and then the Earl of Dunbar built this castle, and it was invested by Edward I, I think it was, and then survived. Edward II fled here after his defeat at the Battle of Bannockburn, and then I think he successfully took it later. It was bombarded at one stage, but the lady in charge of the castle at the time, Black Agnes, what a cracking name that is. Black Agnes, Lady Black Agnes, mocked the people who were actually firing at the castle by getting her ladies-in-waiting to go out and dust the walls. But that noise you can hear in the background is probably about 4 or 5 dozen kittiwakes. They are beautiful little gulls. They're probably my favourite gull. They've got this really sort of dark, sooty eye. And when they fold their wings behind them like that, the primary feathers, the feathers right at the very end, cross. And I've described it in the past as being a bit like a debutante's demurely crossed pins. And it's true, they're just a really elegant little animal. And because this is made out of chunks of undressed red sandstone, predominantly, there's some blonde stuff in there too, and some grey stuff that, for the life of me, I can't figure out, it's still attached. Lots of stones have fallen out over the years, and it creates these perfect nest sites. Well, when I say perfect, not quite perfect. They've added to them over decades and decades, using mud and bits of old fishing gear. There's bits of rope hanging down off this, just to make the absolutely perfect nest site. And it's been in there long enough that there's sort of green stuff growing on it too. But it's lovely. I could stand here for hours just watching these birds. Only discovered recently that Dunbar Harbour was the site of a fishery aimed at trying to recover stocks in the North Sea at the beginning of the 20th century. I think it was just round the corner here, round the other side of the castle. I just love that noise. Our fishing forefathers weren't daft. They knew that fish stocks were being depleted, they were in decline. And in the late 19th century, early 20th century, improvements in fishing technology actually made the situation much, much worse. If you read something like, you know, Neil Gunn's The Silver Darlings, you can see how it happened. So sea fish hatcheries were established in 19 different countries, North America, I think there was some in Scandinavia. And the Fishery Board for Scotland built a hatchery here in Dunbar for hatching plaice, you know, the flatfish plaice. And it was managed by a young Norwegian scientist with the aim of putting fish back into the North Sea to help numbers. And the hatchery was actually built here below Castle Park by the Castle Rocks. And they had pipes to supply seawater for the fish ponds, and experiments were performed on several species of flatfish, not just plaice, sole, lemon sole, turbot. And they produced millions of fish fry. And just before the turn of the century, they transferred the entire operation to Aberdeen, which is why we still have the Aberdeen Marine Laboratory, which continues to operate today. I don't think there's anything, possibly that there's the remnants of what looks like a tank across there in the corner, that would tell you that once upon a time there was a fishery here. But what a cracking wee place Dunbar Harbour is. Full of interest, full of history, and full of sound.
The sounds of Dunbar Harbour, they're a lovely wee place. Coming up, we've got the results of the RSPB's Big Garden Bird Watch, and we find out more about what they tell us, and a tour of Glasgow City Centre, which uncovers some real architectural gems.
Yeah, don't miss that one. And of course, we've got a mystery sound for you today. Have a listen.
Now, Donald Fifofer says, does the mystery sound have something to do with the weaving machine? No. I've no idea where you're coming from there, Donald. And David John Chadwick from Carluke says, I have my hearing aid in this week. I didn't hear the otter last week, only the background noise. I think the mystery sound is a mystery to me still. Yeah, well, me too as well.
Right, and Maureen, Mark and Linda's a lovely dry start to the day here in Rothes. Looking forward to heading down to the Spey to see if we can spot any wildlife other than the anglers. Is today's mystery sound the electronic alarm on Mark's wallet? that sounds when he's rash enough
than that.
To open it.
Much louder than
fantastic
that.
Fantastic program.
It's not a sound that's heard often.
No. Denise, Phil and Reggie, thanks for getting in touch. So if you've got any idea what that mystery sound is, get in touch with us, please. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or text 80295. Your standard network message rate applies. You can call us as well on 08 085 92 95 00. Alex is here to take your calls.
We were talking earlier about the brazen beavers of Pitlochry. Mm-hmm. Ron, our audio supremo this week, it says apparently beavers are very trainable. You can domesticate them, so they're quite friendly animals. And people in North America occasionally find them, you know, as they've been hit by cars or things like that, because they've got no road sense, as we've discussed, and take them into their homes.
Why would you want to do that?
They're
quite big, apparently. Chloe was telling me that, you know,
it's not as high as that.
She said it was about 4 feet off the ground.
Oh, rubbish.
And they've got brown teeth. Do you want an animal with brown teeth in your house?
Well, apparently, one of the downsides is that, you know, they have... I don't know whether this stacks up or not. We would love to try and find somebody who's actually done this. But if you take them into your home, they still have the instinct to build dams. So apparently they collect heaps of soft toys and things and build dams across doorways, and they also chew the doorposts.
Do you want an animal in your house that chews the doorposts?
Anyone who's ever owned a Labrador will think, this is small change.
Yeah.
This is nothing in comparison.
Yeah, or a cat that scratches the carpets. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. North Berwick, not terribly far away from Dunbar, is home to a giant mural made entirely from marine plastic. In fact, it's believed to be the biggest mural of its type in the UK, and it was commissioned in order to make folk think about what's inside, or what's under the surface of our waters and on our beaches. Rachel met Julie Barnes, the artist and campaigner who created the piece down at the harbour, and asked her how she'd got involved with the project.
It was an interesting route, because I'm an artist, that's my role in life, and I paint, but I also like to do interesting things about things I'm passionate about, the environment, animal protection, things like that. And the year before I was approached, I'd created a life-size seal for the Fringe by the Sea, North Berwick, made out of plastics collected from the beach, which I'd done. And that went down really well. It was really appreciated. The message was taken on board. So I was commissioned to create this mural out of over 25,000 pieces of plastic, which had been collected by one woman, Elizabeth Fisher, during lockdown. She spent 100 days, only an hour a day, so not very much time, collecting the plastic. And that figure alone, if you think about it, 25,000 pieces of plastic, just over 100 days, that's a lot.
And from really the same stretch of beach, wasn't it? She kept returning to the same bit.
That's absolutely true. She collected all the plastic from a section of beach in East Lothian, along Nidri Bents.
So what kind of stuff were you presented with?
Ooh. I was presented with literally bags and bags, paper bags I'd like to say, not plastic bags, bags and bags of plastic. And most of it was not colour coordinated at all. It was just like 25, 26 huge bags of plastic. So step one was to go through it all and turn it into different batches of colours to see what actually was available to use.
So what kind of stuff was in there?
So much stuff that really surprised me and obviously shocked me as well. There were things like masses of blue gloves that are used by the fishermen, pollution from netting, rope, creel pots, a huge amount of gun cartridges, which was really shocking and disappointing, loads of everyday items like disposable lighters, plastic cutlery, toothbrushes, food packaging.
Including plastic bags?
Absolutely, plastic bags, that's a hot topic for me, something I'm very passionate about. I really think they should be called bags for death, not bags for life. It makes no sense to me that we are just buying these things made of plastic and then they end up in the seas and the waterways and tragically, as we know, inside the stomachs of animals.
So what you've created is a fairly typical beach scene, really. You've got boats in there, you've got people sitting, enjoying the beach, you've got some swimmers, and of course you've got Bass Rock in the background. You had to have that in when you're, you know, creating something for North Berwick.
I did, yes. I also spoke to some of the people who worked on the harbour, and I wanted to ask them what they would like to see in it as well, because I was mindful and respectful of where it was going to be located. Whilst I was creating it, it was going to be owned by everybody and not just the companies who'd commissioned it. And obviously boats had to feature, and the fact that this area and North Berwick generally is enjoyed by so many people who live here and then visitors as well. So I wanted it to contain something for everybody.
It's really colourful as well. It's very, very eye-catching. Did you have to enhance the colours or treat the plastic in some way to create the effect you wanted?
No, I didn't have to do anything to the plastic, and I was determined not to do anything with the plastic. I wanted to use what I had available so that people could see in its full truth. The technicolour of some of the items was useful in some ways, but also shocking in others. And a lot of the plastic I couldn't use because it was either too dirty or too polluted. And if you bear in mind, children and the public will be seeing this, and obviously the natural impulse is to touch it as well. So I had to be mindful of that.
People must look at it and have mixed emotions, because on the one hand they're thinking, you know, this is a striking piece and it's of scenes that they probably enjoy looking at. You know, beach scenes, it makes you think of lovely long days in the summer. But at the same time, they will also be aware that this has been made entirely from plastic that's found on the beach.
Yes, and it's that duality that I was hoping to get across, that like the beaches, like the seas, from the distance, they look all safe and shiny and beautiful. The mural looks all colourful and it's, as you say, it's happy scenes. But as you get closer, you can see the truth, and that truth is not a nice truth at all.
And do you think people look at it and try to identify what's actually in there?
Yes, they do. It's almost like the Where's Wally images. You look at it and you think, oh, look at that, it's a toothbrush. Oh, no, that's a tiny child's toy. Oh, that's a gun cartridge. And you can actually start to look at it like a huge jigsaw that works together from a distance. And then each little piece has its own story.
What was the one message, if there is such a thing, that you wanted to get across?
First of all, wake up, everybody. If there is anybody still in denial about the amount of plastic which we, as a population, humankind, is creating and allowing to be dumped and just thrown into our waterways, then please wake up and see the truth. We can make a difference. I know it's overwhelming. I feel overwhelmed with a lot of things that are going on in the world today. But plastic waste is one of those things that I think we can all make a difference with in our own homes, in our lifestyles, but also lobbying the people that we pay to represent us to stop some of the things happening, including plastic pollution. Yes, it's also a global problem, so that requires countries and organisations to work together, but the change has to start with all of us.
Julie Barnes, artist and campaigner there. I haven't seen that mural yet in North Berwick, but I'll make a point of it the next time I go down
there. Next time you're down there. Make a note, sounds fascinating.
Things like, you know, she was talking about the shotgun cartridges and things. Unless it was wildfowling along the coast, I'm not sure about that. I know that occasionally they pick up... It's not really shotgun cartridges. It's something to do with shooting. It's like a sort of plastic device thing, but it comes... They float right the way across the Atlantic, and you get them on the beaches in Orkney and Shetland.
Right, okay.
You know, so it's just...
So they can come a far distance then.
Oh, fair distance. But, I mean, the amount of rubbish there is, you know, on the sea is just terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, and how long is it going to take for that plastic to actually decompose and, you know, sort of disappear?
Forever.
Yeah.
Sad.
Assuming it actually does. Anyway, coming up, we were mentioning the fact that it was light this morning, which it was. As I drove up this morning, there was reflections of red in the window, and that was the sunrise. Finally in the air, and we'll be talking to a fashion designer who's making clothes using foodstuffs.
And of course, we also have a mystery sound for you this morning.
It's not an easy one.
It's tricky. Alistair and Elgin says, good morning, Linda and Mark. Good morning to you, Alistair. It's another fine, breezy morning in Elgin. Let's all enjoy summer before winter comes back next week. He thinks an interesting mystery sound this week. I'm thinking along the lines of an enraged kitty wake after being disturbed by Mark.
No, not quite. Mike and the Dogs says, morning from Torra, a bit cool and cloudy this morning. Got to visit the Afford Community Railway yesterday and saw the old Aberdeen tram that's been restored. That's a great thing, that. He says, is the mystery sound something to do with dolphins recorded underwater? Nope.
Patrick and Brechin, a red squirrel squaring up to another red squirrel.
Lorna on Uddingston says, something saying whistle. When out of doors finishes, I will get up, put the kettle on. What do you mean you'll get up when we finish? That's 8 o'clock in the morning, it's nearly lunchtime. Says, I will get up, put the kettle on, feed the cat, refill the bird feeders on my round tree, live mealworms for the robins, and seeds for Stevie Starling's extra long beak. He's not like other starlings. Cup of tea, biscuits, and bird watching. Happy to start the day. There's not a guess in there at all. Other than something saying whistle, possibly.
Whistle, possibly. Kate McDonald in Coatbridge. Good morning, Kate. Is the mystery sound an electronic alarm for a fishing rod alerting the fisherman when there's a bite? Ooh. And she wants to say thank you very much for the bit on Dunbar. She really enjoyed it. An absolute gem of a place to visit for us over the years.
No, it is nice. Abby in slightly sunny Abernights says, I thought I had a giant bat in my lounge this morning, but it must be a stylophone recording from 1969. Maybe I'm still dreaming, though. Sleepy me. I suspect you might be.
Yes, well, do get in touch. There's still time. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295. Your standard network message rate applies. And you can call us too on 08085. I should say 085 92 95 00. Alex is here to take your calls.
I can never get that right.
It's a bit of a mouthful, that, isn't it?
It is.
You've got it right by now, mind you.
Listen, I've been doing it for years. I can't do it at all. Last week, we got really quite bogged down in the weather. It was raining. Boy, was it raining. And it seemed like it had been raining since the start of the year. But this week, I reckon there's been a glimmer of hope. Is spring here to stay? Penny Latton-Stewart has been thinking about this very thing.
This way. This way. Come on.
We moved to the Great Glen exactly 4 years ago in the first week of the first lockdown, and spring at that time felt disjointed, a bit odd. There was a joy of watching a landscape and wilderness around us wake up in a place which was new and unfamiliar, set against the fear of the world waking up to what might lie in store in the aftermath of the COVID pandemic. Fast forward 4 years, and spring takes on a very different hue. Our fourth spring here brings with it the excitement of what comes next, not fear. An excitement born of getting to know and love this landscape over the time we've been here. When you live in a big, open landscape like we do in the Great Glen, it's impossible not to be almost super sensitive to the change of seasons. When everything around you is on the move, it sets you into action too, physically and emotionally. We sleep with the blinds pulled high in a bedroom which faces southeast. In winter, it makes no difference. The nights are bitumen black. But for me, the first sign of spring is the joy of being woken by sunlight pouring itself over the hill opposite, above Alduri Castle, and bouncing back up off the loch. I'll never grow tired of that spring sun bursting into the sky and my consciousness each morning. So much better than the sound of the alarm. I understand that desire, need, for seedlings to start to unfurl so they can bask in that light and warmth. It makes me want to unfurl each day too. Go on. Of course, that idea of waking from sleep to greet spring is as old as, well, spring. Poet Mary Oliver describes it as a black bear, her tongue like a red fire, touching the grass, the cold water. The only question, how to love this world? Here in the Glen, the flowers show their love in little bursts of yellow. The acid, sharp egg yolk of the gorse washes the croft in competition with the daffodils and crocuses nodding in the orchard, although I never remember when or where I planted them. Next to the early flowers and buds, the birds, of course, are the most obvious heralders of spring, busy loving the world with all that business of building nests in a riot of song each morning. There's a riot, too, in the pond with all the frogs and their croaking, which has become the soundscape to each dusk. For our bees, spring just now takes the form of the occasional sleepy foray from the hive. whenever the sun burns warm enough. But for them, it's a waiting game, in spite of all the coconut-scented gorse beckoning them to come play. And it's that bit of spring that really hooks me. The idea that the landscape is opening up its arms and inviting you to come on and love it. To come and play.
What have you got? Eddie, that's too big.
Eddie loves a stick the size of his body, or twice the size of his body.
That's massive. Go on then, break it up.
But while I do love those bold, obvious shouts of spring, it's the more subtle lifts and shifts which move me most. Although they're all rooted in that gift of a second or two more sunlight each day. I've always been someone to pack every day till it brims over. I struggle a bit with winter, not because the dark depresses me, it doesn't, but because it seems to bookend and shorten all that possibility. But with spring, like the leaves, I uncurl and open up to what might come.
Charlie.
I planted tomato and chilli seeds back in mid-February, and now each day I visit them on their windowsill, amazed at how much they've grown already, loving the sense of potential which lies in those tiny first leaves. Come August, these seedlings will have created a jungle, filling the polytunnel with red and yellow fruits. And it's that idea of potential being realised that I think truly moves me about spring. We sow our own seeds in the heart of winter, at the turn of the year, when we take stock, reflect, then look ahead. And now, like the tomato plants, my own seedlings are pushing through the surface, nudging me to decide what I want to bear fruit this year. How do I want to fill my own internal polytunnel? Dreams of a writing course, of a trial ride on the tandem we've been painstakingly restoring during the darker months, of getting to spend long hours in the garden, growing food and hanging out with the bees, persuading them to offer up a jar or two of honey. For me, all of this locked away energy and ambition for what the year might hold is finally being released. And as the days lengthen and stretch and the plants reach for the light, we do too. And each morning, when that sun wakes me, instead of burying myself back in the duvet, I'm itching to get up and at it. Quite literally, with a spring in each step.
Come on.
Where's Charlie?
Charlie! That's a better size of stick. That's a better size of stick. Come on. Charlie!
Where's he gone? Where's he gone?
Penny Latton Stewart there with some musings on spring. And, you know, we were talking to the dog earlier, it's like that old thing, it's, you know, it's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog.
Yes.
But you see these tiny, tiny little, you know, Jack Russells or something like that, with, you know, like 8 foot stick. You know, look what I've got.
Well, I saw a dog, I can't think where I was out on a run or out on my bike, and it had literally about 6 sticks in its mouth across the way. And the man who owned the dog was like, stop! Drop all these sticks, you can't move for them.
Yeah. When you think of Glasgow city centre, don't know, what do you get? I mean, heaps of folk, shoppers, buses laden with passengers, police sirens, all of the above. What a lot of people don't consider, however, is just how incredibly rich Glasgow is in architectural history and really, really impressive Victorian buildings.
Yes, the work of Alexander Thomson and Sir George James Burnett are just some of those who have stood the test of time. One man who enjoys highlighting the subtle features and lesser-known facts of Glasgow's architecture is Neil Murphy. He's the director of the Glasgow City Heritage Trust. Through his regular social media posts, he makes people aware of the beautiful buildings. I went to meet him at one of the city's best-known landmarks.
George Grey's quite a complex history over kind of the course of 3 centuries. So it starts out really being, this is kind of agricultural land on the edge of the city centre. And then it's not until kind of by the time that Glasgow begins to grow, and this whole area around here gets laid out as Glasgow's second new town. And so they create this kind of double block square in the centre of it, but they don't really know what to do with it. And it's kind of originally described as this kind of no man's land. It's not until kind of the 1820s that the kind of the landowners around the square, who there's a whole kind of Palladian development, sort of Palladian townhouses and terraces, so much lower scale than what we see nowadays. And they get this idea that what they want then is this quite sort of pretentious West End square, which is kind of coming from London or from Edinburgh. And they petition the city fathers at the time to help them erect iron railings around the square. So they want this kind of prestigious kind of garden space in the centre of their square. The city fathers help them out. The Glaswegian mob aren't particularly happy about this because it cuts off the route from kind of where the population is down Argyll Street up to the factories, up to the north and Tanhead and Kirkadens. And so at various points you see them trying to tear it down. It really has quite a fascinating history because it's not till later in the 1860s, after you get the city architect John Carrick leads this delegation to Paris and sees what Baron Haussmann is up to in Paris for Napoleon III and all these kind of grand boulevards and new squares being opened up. And he brings those ideas back to Glasgow. And that's the first time anybody's done that in the UK.
So should we go around the corner and see what you're going to show me now then?
Absolutely. Well, I was going to show you the Italian Centre. I mean, that's 1990s, early 1990s, kind of. This is about regenerating Glasgow at that point on the back of things like the Garden Festival. And kind of this is another Glasgow Renaissance. So let's pop into the Italian Centre because it's really interesting. So these were kind of semi-derelict warehouse buildings which have been turned into tenements. Let's see if we can nip through this archway here.
I don't think I've ever been in here before, and I've lived in Glasgow for about 20 years.
It's fascinating inside. So it's literally designed as this kind of Italianate courtyard inside. And it's how they use art in it as well is really fascinating. So this is by Page and Park Architects, who are still going strong. They're really interesting practice, and this is one of their early works. But it's very postmodern in appearance.
So because you've got the tiles and you've got a fountain. What have you got here? This is
a little kind of rill of a fountain running through it. But I love the space in the heart of the city. And it's really nice, quiet retreat. And it's funny because nobody knows it's here.
Well, I didn't know it was here. And it's open to the public. You can just come wandering in here. Nobody's going to chase you.
Yep. And it's one of the great postmodern buildings, not just in Glasgow, but in Scotland and the UK as well.
But it does look very Italian. We could be transported to somewhere like Venice. So.
Indeed, you absolutely could. So I'll take you out through here.
Okay.
Other really interesting buildings on Ingram Street too, which are worth a nose yet.
And is it residential all above here?
It's all residential up above.
I used to be a police officer in a previous life, and one of my colleagues said to me, whenever you're walking the beat in the city centre, always look up.
Yes.
And it's so true. So now we've come out onto Ingram Street, and this is where all the fancy sort of designer shops are.
Indeed, yes. So this is more, I'm a total Sir John James Burnett fanboy, I have to confess. I think he's a really good architect. After Charles Rennie Mackintosh and Alexander Greig Thompson, he's Glasgow's third architect of kind of international stature. These are some of his works. So the Glasgow Savings Bank, which is just this incredibly charming little building, which that's the dome of St. Peter's kind of miniaturised up above. And then this door case actually comes from Oxford originally. It's St. Mary's Church in Oxford, and he kind of adapts it to a Glasgow context. And so you've got St. Mungo in the centre, and that's by Sir George Frampton, who was one of the new sculptors in the new sculpture movement in Victorian Britain.
So who are the two men like holding up the pillars? Who are they?
Holding the thing up. They're just kind of, I presume they're kind of, well... This is where you can get interesting metaphors in Glasgow. Are they the workers, like, holding the whole, you know, capitalist institution up? I don't know. And then Glasgow's love of a coat of arms in the centre as well, with a tiny little St. Mungo directly below the big St. Mungo. Yeah. And the sugar barley columns, it's the most wonderful piece. And if you see behind that, you've got these maidens who are kind of holding symbols of the city. So there's industry on that side, and then there's fruit coming in on the other side as well. It's just the most fantastic piece of work, really beautiful.
And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I've never noticed that dome before either. I'm shocked that I'm actually admitting that.
So it was used last year for the filming of Batgirl, and then it's Batgirl's never actually made it into the cinemas because it cancelled. It's such a shame because it would have looked fabulous. Yeah. So
okay, and cool. Right next to us, another impressive building.
Absolutely.
It's even higher.
That's again, it's Sir John James Burnett. Notionally by his father, but this is John Burnett Sr. But this is when Sir John James Burnett first comes back from Paris, and he's only 19 years old when he designs this. And it's his father's kind of feeling is that, you know, I've given my son this first-class education as an architect, better set him loose. And this is what he does. And it's just the most, I mean, I just like every time I pass it, it's like, he was 19 years old. Yeah. Imagine having that kind of self-confidence to do that.
This is the Corinthian building.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But it ends up kind of ultimately being a bank building, and then it ends up being a sheriff court, and you get different architects being involved in it. So David Hamilton, who's kind of the father of Glasgow's architecture, and he does Goma in the distance. So he does one of the banking halls on the back. And it's really, when you look at the entrance, it's incredibly Parisian in flavour. So it's really quite good fun.
Wonderful. I mean, do you see architecture like this anywhere else in the UK?
Yes, you do. I mean, it's kind of very much like parts of Liverpool and parts of London. So, but a lot of that is kind of disappearing. So that's what makes Glasgow City Centre quite special, because a lot of it still survives here, which is great. We're quite fortunate that way.
That's Neil Murphy from the Glasgow City Heritage Trust there. And it was a bitterly cold February day that I can still feel the cold and wet going into my bones, thanks to him.
I would imagine the real problem with that would have been just trying to narrow it down to a few examples.
Yeah, we walked further, actually. We went to the Goma, and there's a really fascinating, you know, where the Duke of Wellington horse statue, that obviously the cone always goes on top
always.
Of that. We stopped there, and beside that, there's this really intricate bronze sculpture with lots of detail in it of battle scenes, and I mean, we could have done a half an hour programme on that alone. Yeah, there's just so much, and that was just a tiny section of Glasgow City Centre that we walked through.
You spoke about that 19-year-old architect who designed a building, you know, and terrifying in and of itself. But, you know, I think whoever first put the cone on the Duke of Wellington's head, you know, because that has to be... I honestly can't think of a more iconic image for Glasgow than that.
Exactly.
That is it.
It's been used in gin and things like that, I think.
Sorts of stuff.
Yeah. Coasters and stuff like that, too. Yeah.
You name it. But it's just, you know, as they say with Gibraltar, you know, if the apes ever leave the rock, that's it. You know, if the cone ever comes off... And, you know, and I know they've put traffic cones on other statues in Glasgow, but that's not right. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to go on the Duke of Wellington's head.
That person needs to be tracked down.
Probably has been.
Felt the collar.
Somebody's collar got felt.
Yes, exactly.
Every year, every January, the RSPB asks people to spend an hour taking note of the birds that visit their gardens. It is a massive citizen science project. This year, 40,000 folk took part in that in Scotland, and the results are out now. Joining us now to tell us more is Shona McLennan, Community Engagement Officer with RSPB Scotland. Good morning, Shona. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm good, thanks.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Thanks very much for taking the time to do this. What were the key findings of the survey this year? What are the headlines?
Like you said, there was at least over 40,000 people that took part in the survey this year, which is great. That's quite an increase on even on last year. And they counted over 800,000 birds of nearly 50 different species, which is amazing.
And which ones stand out, Shona, in terms of, you know, the type of birds that were identified?
Well, we've got a top 10 in Scotland that came from the actual survey. So, again, for the 13th year, we had the house sparrows holding the top spot, and the starlings coming in at number 2, with the blue tits coming in at number 3. So we've got, you know, they're usual, but again, with... The problem with them is, since the survey was done, since 1979, the numbers overall have been coming down and been declining, and in particularly with the starlings, they are now nearly 60% have decreased over that period.
And have you any idea why that's the case?
It's down to a different number of reasons. It's probably more down to land use. land use and climate change and different things like that contain to, you know, making sure habitats are suitable. They like to eat a lot of insects, so making sure there's lots of insects in the habitats that they like to be in. All of that kind of is partly a reason why these numbers are going down.
And what can we do individually then, Shona, to try and mitigate the impact of this? I mean, climate change is such a huge, big thing, isn't it? But individually, is there anything that we can do in our own gardens to try and attract birds?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of things that people can do. A lot of people have now started feeding birds with using feeders, and they've been great. That's how, you know, the big garden bird watch kind of came about, was, you know, a lot of people had started putting out feeders and counting how many birds they were getting in their gardens from that. They can also put nest boxes up to, you know, our gardens are really good places. They act like corridors for wider habitats, so it's really a nice area, you know, they can be quite safe places for birds and to come and feed and nest. So putting up nest boxes, giving them a chance to be able to breed, is a really good way of helping them.
You're speaking to us from Stornoway. I mean, how are things across in the Western Isles?
Well, it's quite interesting because obviously over here we don't have as many trees, but we still have quite a lot of these garden birds. And at the top of the list here is actually the starlings themselves. And they are doing really well over here. And we have the house sparrows are second. And then we have our third is actually the rock dove, which is interesting.
Okay, why the rock dove?
I'm not aware. Well, it's a type of pigeon. People will maybe refer it to as a feral pigeon as well. And
you get them in sea cliffs and things like that. You know?
Yeah, they're known in Gaelic as in Callum and Mara, so the sea dove. So they're, you know, they can be, they do nest kind of in, at sea cliffs and places like that. So they are coastal birds, and over here we've got quite a few of them. And obviously a good habitat for them.
And it's been quite a wet sort of January, hasn't it, and through into spring. Has that impacted on the numbers at all, do you think?
I don't think it's impacted the numbers. It might, it kind of doesn't help when it makes things harder for them. You know, it makes it harder to get food. Over here we've got a lot of wind, so, you know, that tends to impact. And I think, you know, even the mainland have had quite a bit of wind this winter as well. So that gives, you know, that uses up a lot of energy when you're having to fight against it. I mean, you even feel it yourself when you're out in the wind.
Tell me about it.
You feel knackered after you've been out in it, walking in it. So you can imagine what it's like for a small bird if they're out in that wind, how difficult it must be to kind of go and find food and find places of shelter. And that's the sort of thing that, yeah, could impact the birds' numbers.
Yeah, I had it. Sorry, Mark, I went and did the Hebridean Way. I've tried to do it twice now and I've been battled back by the wind. And I was lucky enough to hear a corncrake. Are the corncrakes back yet at all, Shona?
I haven't had any reports yet to say that they're back, but I'm pretty sure they'll be on their way with the southerlies that we've had the last couple of weeks. So they will have had a wee bit of help with that.
Literally a tailwind. Going back to what you were saying about starlings, you know, doing well in your area, and earlier you said that part of the problem is that, you know, there's not the insects about that there used to be in grubs and things. Why are they doing particularly well in the Western Isles? Is it different farming practices there?
Yeah, that can help. You know, the crofting methods that are used over in the islands tend to help a lot of different species. And we're finding that certain species over here do better than even on the mainland in Scotland, just because of the kind of methods that we use over here. And it is usually traditional crofting methods that help. With that, with cattle grazing and, you know, holding back cutting harvests and things like that. So, yeah, there's different ways of helping, definitely, that we see that definitely help the island bird life over here.
Aye. Shona, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That was kind of you.
No problem at all.
All right, Shona McLennan there from the RSPB. She's their community engagement officer. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stevens. Sitting right next to me at the fire area Beech Grove is Linda Sinclair. If you miss any of this, think black burning shame, but there are a few ways of listening again.
Yes, you can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, also available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen to the podcast. Get in touch, which is what Philip did. He says, my wife and I have just discovered your wonderful show. We're listening down in Hastings in East Sussex. We honeymooned in Loch Fyne for a week and then drove the NC500 in 2021.
And we totally fell in love with Scotland and now have a purchase going through on a wonderful old schoolhouse in Furness right on Loch Fyne. We are slowly working through your back catalogue and can't wait to be listening whilst overlooking the loch. Keep up the great broadcasting, Philip and Lydia. It's time for our mystery sound again and have a listen. Here is.
Kenny in Dunfermline thinks that might be a farmer's nail or staple gun for fencing.
Betty Mayer in Lerwick says today's mystery sound kind of sounds like the swish of an angler's fishing line.
Ooh, that's a good one. Davy Ferdinacht says dentist roll. No.
Nope. Kate in Ayr, is it a noise alarm system to deter brazen beavers creating dams where they are not wanted in water management?
Eric from Rosalind thinks it might be Johnny the Cow, which was their son's squeaky toy from 29 years ago.
Well remembered. Donald near Oban, is a mystery sound a beaver whistling through its teeth in exasperation at all these plastic tree protectors?
Ian and Tully Nessel thought it might be call of a wildfowl species, maybe widgeon. Widgeon do have a funny high call. Mm-hmm.
Davy G tuned in for my weekly Out of Doors fix, struggling with the mystery sound this week. It sounds like a very unusual animal or bird call.
Mm.
Yes.
All these are good guesses.
All good guesses. If you think you know what the mystery sound is, then get in touch. There's still time. Outofdoors at bbc.co.uk. Text 80295. Your standard network message rate applies. And you can call us as well. 08 085 92 95 00. Alex is here to take your calls.
As our climate changes, scientists at the Royal Botanic Garden, Edinburgh, are looking at ways plants may be used to combat extreme urban weather events. Now, the Plants with Purpose initiative is a five-year project which will use the RGBE's four sites around Scotland as living laboratories. Now, I found out more about the scheme from one of the scientists involved, Caitlin Johnson.
This is our rain garden. It's a beautiful space filled with many different species of plants. But this one's serving a specific purpose in that this lawn used to flood completely. It was just a regular grass lawn and all of the water coming down off the hill anytime we had a rainstorm, which are becoming more intense, more severe. As our climate shifts a bit, the flooding was becoming more severe. So we had to do something about that flooding problem. And as a garden, we figured, you know, botanists, let's fix it with plants.
How do you approach that, though? Because, I mean, do you go to an area which is traditionally very, very wet and look at the plants that actually grow there, you know, how do you do it?
Yes, so we need to have an approach that looks at everything at once instead of trying to address it piecemeal. And nature, you know, works within a system. It doesn't break things up like humans do. So we looked at what was already functioning well in nature and then said, can we learn from that and apply it in a way that is more intensified. So that's what a rain garden is. We looked at plants that do well in wet conditions, but also are able to handle drought conditions, because that's what we're starting to see with our changing climate. We have a weather station here at RBGE, and we're tracking what's happening. And what we're seeing is that we have more intense storms with more water over a shorter period of time, but we also have longer stretches of drought in between. And different plants adapt to different conditions. So it's looking at what a plant already does well and then saying, let's use that like workhorse power of a plant to soak up water or provide shade or whatever a human needs in an individual situation and put them all together and we'll solve that issue. So that's our rain garden here. We dug out some of the space to create a well so that the water that was flooding down had a place to pool, and then took that soil and dumped it right next to it. And that's this berm that we're standing on. It's just a little lip to help keep the water in. And then you needed to modify the soil a bit by adding gravel and sand, you know, larger pieces to create that soil structure again, because soil is supposed to have a structure with spaces air pockets in between it that water can fill. So we needed the water to be able to sink down into the ground and then put plants here that amplify that. So they're able to take up all of that water, and it was a win-win-win all around.
For years, gardeners have been matching the plant to the conditions in their gardens. But this is slightly different. This is using plants to sort of try and attenuate the effects of climate change.
Exactly. And it's using not just the condition that the plant likes to grow in, but also some simple landscaping mechanics. You know, a lot of times humans, we see a complex problem and we think it's got to be a really, really difficult solution. But nature's kind of got it in hand. So changing the structure of the land slightly to create a place for the water to well and a lip to keep it in, and then putting the plants in that condition, changes a lot for the structure of the land and the ability for the plants to do what you're trying to get them to do, which is grow in the environment that's suited for them, but create that environment in a place that also solves problems like flooding. Our new Plants with Purpose project is a new 5-year research program that will bring on 2 new PhD students. And it's really focused on what we've learned here. You know, you were saying that you have plants that you already put them in the conditions that you find in your garden. This is coming at it from the opposite way. So not here's the conditions, I'll put a plant there. It's what can this plant do? Soak up water, deal with heat, provide shade, and putting them where we already need those features. So all the wonderful traits that plants have and using them to purposefully solve issues. So that's this new program that's going to happen. And the rain garden's only one feature of that.
So we're coming out of winter, we're going into spring. Flooding is in everybody's minds at the moment because there's been a hell of a lot of rain this winter and what have you. Can you use plants to ameliorate the effects of drought, really hot conditions too?
Yes, you can. So there was a study recently on changing temperatures and how gardens and green spaces can help with that. And they found that botanic gardens were far and above better than, you know, just a regular open green space or a park for doing that. And I'd love to say it's because our botanical knowledge is just, you know, oh, so amazing. but actually, it's because we have more of a structure to our garden. So you have very tall plants.
Okay, it's three-dimensional.
Yes, it's three-dimensional. You're getting into that Z space. So
now you're going to need to explain that for us. What does that mean? Z space.
So you have an XY axis in mathematics. Z is taking it up into three dimensions from two dimensions. So we're not just looking at the ground, but also how do plants and temperature and water and air behave together as you kind of move up above our heads to tree height.
It's just not rediscovering what classic Arab gardens knew for many, many years, essentially. You know, if you use plants, you know, with the whole business of transpiration and what have you, you know, it is a way of increasing the moisture in the air and cooling things down.
Yes, so if plants are doing a whole lot of work in that they're, you know, they're photosynthesizing, they're sending out oxygen, they're doing everything we've known they do for a long time. So plant also has heat and water properties. And one of the things that evapotranspiration does is cool things down. Mm-hmm. So if you have understory plants, you know, low, say like knee height, you have middle range plants, bushes, small trees, you have taller plants, and you have them all together, then you're creating a larger space for all of that cooling to happen. So it's not just shading that creates cooling. It's the trees actually living, the trees and plants living their lives, that's cooling the air. So having the three-dimensional structure is what creates a big difference.
We're standing here in the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, but essentially you have another 3 huge laboratories that you can play with, you can experiment with.
We do. So we're looking at how plants behave in all of these different conditions. So looking at how Benmore or Doic are different from Edinburgh. And we can look at, as storms hit, in the way that trees and plants and, you know, mushrooms and fungus and mycorrhizae under the soil, everything that's working together, including something that we're trying to do here in the rain garden, is increase biodiversity. So it's not just plants and how they interact with other plants, but they're part of a full ecosystem. So we're looking at them now as how they can mitigate flooding for us. We're looking at them now as how they can provide nesting habitat for pollinators. We talk about pollinators, we call them pollinators, and we're defining them by their job as adults. pollinators have an entire lifespan, and often we don't think about where they're overwintering, what they're feeding on, where they lay their eggs, and a lot of that is plants. Something like our rain garden here, we've had it for 5 years. This area never floods. I actually came out to take pictures of it in the storm the other day, and you know, the problem with it working so well is it looks like nothing's happening. You wouldn't even know there's a rainstorm because it doesn't flood. The plants are doing amazingly well. It's a new feature for visitors to come and see. And we save money because this area is not irrigated at all. We don't water this area. It's just done with the rain.
Caitlin Johnson there, a scientist at the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh. It's an interesting scheme saying that they're going to be putting together almost a manual of plants saying, you know, not most times you get the plants and it says, you know, and these are plants that are good for these kind of conditions. This will be a manual that will say these are plants that will be good to alter these conditions.
Right, a different strategy.
You know, to mitigate these conditions and things. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's almost like a toolkit.
Yeah.
Interesting idea. Yeah. Now, the fashion industry used to have a really bad reputation for being unsustainable. But they've been trying to amend that, and frankly, it doesn't need to be that way. Designer Emily Remakers has been experimenting with natural biomaterials to create a garment. And she's been using all sorts of stuff, mushrooms, algae, you name it, apple, something called apple leather, never heard of it. Maud Start met with Emily for a kind of picnic. And it wasn't so much about what they were going to eat as what they might be wearing.
The exhibition is all about biomaterials, which are materials made from living things. And I have created the dress that is in the exhibition out of many different kinds of biomaterials.
Can you just give me a description of the dress?
It is a slip dress style dress, and it is covered with applique elements, and they are designed to look a bit like bracket fungus. And some people think they look a little bit like flowers as well. So they're kind of these frondy, lobe-like shapes scattered all over the dress. And they're all different kinds of fabrics. So some of them are tencel, some are silk, cork, linen, and some of them are the apple leather. And the base dress itself is also lino-printed with shapes inspired by fungus structures. And it's got a cape over the top, which is a bronzy, goldy colour made of apple leather. And that I've laser cut that, again, with lots of shapes inspired by fungus structures.
So looking at this apple, you can't really picture it being worn against your skin. How exactly can you make this into fabric?
So the company that makes it uses the pulp that's left over from the juice and compote industry. They dry it and turn it into a powder. And then they mix it with other materials to make the apple leather. So I think they said there was about 3 apples to every metre of the fabric they made. It looks really similar to other polyurethane leathers and behaves in a similar way, but the inclusion of the apple reduces the amount of plastic that has to be included in the garment, and it also helps to support a circular economy for the growers and to find a use for that waste that would otherwise just go into landfill.
Well, so apples aside, visually, the dress is very much inspired by fungi. But you've actually also used a fabric which is made from mushrooms.
So one of the fabrics is called mooskin, and it is a parasitic fungus that grows in the wild in subtropical forests. And it's been really interesting to work with.
When you take this mycelium material, what is the process of actually turning it into the dress?
With this one, with the mooskin, it's 100% natural, and it came to me as it's been harvested from the tree. They just roll it flat slightly, and it has a suedey kind of spongy texture. So it's quite sculptural and structural, and I use it in the headpiece of the garment, yeah, I kind of just treated it like any other fabric and I hand sewed it in. It's one of those fabrics that once you sew it, you can't make any mistakes, because if you unpick it, you'll be able to see all the holes in it. So that was I had to be very considerate about what I was going to do with it, and I didn't have very much of it because this is all still in prototype, early development stages. But yeah, my dog found it fascinating. When it arrived at my house, he spent about a minute with his nose right against it, sniffing away, trying to work out what it was.
Can you smell it?
No, there was nothing. No smell to me. Very satisfying to touch. Very sort of suedey and felty.
Okay, and what are the actual benefits of this other than it being presumably more eco-friendly?
I mean, that's the main one, really, is that it has potential to replace lots of different materials in our society that are at the moment traditionally made from basically fossil fuels. Plastic comes from fossil fuels, and a lot of synthetic fibres in fashion, your nylons, your polyesters, that kind of thing, those are all plastic. And every time we wear them, we're releasing microplastics into the environment. Every time we wash them in our washing machines, we're releasing microplastics into the water system. So it has potential in that area to avoid that. It's a natural product. It biodegrades completely. And we can grow it sustainably, or have the potential to grow it sustainably and farm it in a way that doesn't have the huge impacts that other fabrics do, even natural ones like cotton, which is an incredibly thirsty plant and has a very high carbon footprint in its manufacturing process. Lovely.
Cheers. We have here a delicious cup of warm hibiscus tea, which coincidentally, or not, is one of the flowers that you use to dye the dress. How did that work?
Yes, so the base of the dress is made out of lyocell, which is wood pulp. It's made from cellulose, and that's actually one of the most sustainable fabric options that's available on the market at an industrial scale globally. So if you're looking to make a sustainable choice for your wardrobe, lyocell is a really good option. As well as that, it's actually the brand of lyocell that I'm using is Tencel, and they have a closed-loop manufacturing process and work very hard to try and be as sustainable as possible. So I dyed that with hibiscus flowers, which are a natural product, so they're also a biomaterial, and it does make a beautiful palette of colours from really deep reds all the way up to very pale pinks, which is kind of the colour that my dress has gone, is a very pale pink. And I also dyed some of the linens and the silks, and those took on darker shades. I really love the palette. It felt very earthy, the different tones. I wanted it all to look quite earthy and to highlight that connection to the natural world, and the cause that we should be exploring these avenues to see what kind of potential is out there to live more sustainably.
Designer Emily Raymaker's there with Maud Start, and I'm kicking myself actually, because apparently you can go and see the dress for yourself at the National Museum of Scotland, where it's being exhibited as part of the Growing Home exhibition. And I was at the Surgeon's Hall just this last week, which is literally just around the corner, and if I'd thought about it, I could have taken a turn in and seen the dress for myself.
I would like to know if there's any use for Apple stocks, though, because I seem to collect them in my car.
Just
a thought there.
That exhibition, be quick, because apparently it's finishing the 14th of April.
Yeah, get a move on.
Which is tomorrow.
Yes, we're middle of April already, and the sun's coming out here in Aberdeen. Wonderful. So just north of Glasgow, in the shadow of the Campses, sits Mugdock Country Park, which has been a draw for visitors for decades. The vast park, with its woods and trails and a 14th century castle, attracts families, dog walkers and trail runners. It's also a popular site for TV and film productions, with some big budget Hollywood movies shooting there. I went to meet Pam Grieve, the park's development officer, who liaises with location scouts to organise the bookings.
I started here just about 8.5 years ago, so the biggest one that I have had here is outlooking.
You fight for God, for honour, for country, for family, for yourselves, I do not care, so long as you fight!
And where we are actually standing now, if we just turn round, you can see this, just the remnants of where the military road was for the battle scene, which was the Battle of Loudoun Hill.
And Outlaw King, for those who don't know, was a film about Robert the Bruce starring Chris Pine. So quite a big Hollywood actor was here, right where we're standing right now.
Yes, that's correct. Unfortunately, I didn't get to meet Chris, but we were very lucky to get to come on set, which was wonderful. And it was quite enormous, but it was great to experience that.
How long has Mugdock Country Park been used for filming productions like these?
If you look, we've got a sort of history trail, and if you look in that, it does say back in the 60s, I think it was the Borderers.
So what do you think makes the park so attractive for these film crews then? What makes it so special? I mean, it's a huge area of ground, isn't it?
It is, and obviously you can just look at it, it's absolutely gorgeous. But the other thing is, it's great, it's only 10 miles from Glasgow. So the locality's great for film crews, can come like daily and stuff like that.
And of course, it's quite varied, isn't it, the landscape? So we're standing here in the middle of a field, but there's like a wee outcrop of sort of pine-type trees there. There's a forest round about it, there's trails, you've got an old castle. Do you think that's the reason why the film people love it?
I think so, yes. And it's not only used for sort of period stuff, things like that. We've had comedies here as well. You know, if it's wanting some in the open space, we've got comedies. We've got a lovely big moorland as well. So, yeah, we've got a real great sort of diverse of areas, yeah.
So we're just coming through this gate here out of the Khyber Field now, Pam. And this, well, the last film that was here, we had to do some work on this gate, did they?
Yeah, so what we had, I mean, we have sheep in the field, but the farmer organised with the production to move the sheep out when they were shooting, and here, like this gate and all the fence right along that fence line was taken down because of the way they were shooting. Obviously, they couldn't have that in the shot, so that was all taken down, put up. You wouldn't know.
These people that must happened. Spend a lot of money, these Hollywood blockbuster people, who we can't say who they were, who were filming here just recently. So we're now, Pam, walking towards Mugdock Castle, which must be a huge draw for film crews.
Yes, we get a lot of requests for stuff down here, and we've, again, Outlaw King used this as part of theirs within the castle grounds. We can go in a wee minute. Oh, they had their market in there, and just to the... just across from it was where they had their wee village as well. I don't know if you'd been up here, but when they were building all the huts, people were free still to sort of walk by and stuff and see. So it was quite a sight.
I remember seeing that. You could actually wander around about it, little thatched roofs and so forth. You thought, this is so bizarre. I've got access to a film set here.
Yes, I think that's what was it was good for visitors as well, that they felt quite involved. They weren't just pushed out and couldn't go to areas. Obviously, when they were filming, it was all cut off. But in between, they were really good at letting people go by and stuff. Uh-huh.
So this castle, what's the history of it? Can you give us an idea?
The sort of records show that it dates back to about 1360.
Right.
So yes, it's pretty old. The South Tower's had some work done in it, and you can still go in it. We used to do open days in it pre-COVID. We haven't done them so much now, but we're starting to get that back, and it's used for filming, it's used for weddings. The Comedy Unit have done a film inside it. But it's not just for stuff that sort of suits its age.
And there was a werewolf film filmed here many, many moons ago.
Yes, there was. Now, I think that was in 2005. The film was Wild Country.
We'll have to stay together. It won't attack you if we're together.
I think we actually have the DVD of it, but yes, that was filmed here.
And an advert for whiskey, you were telling me.
Yes, there was an advert for whiskey here. It was for Lagavulin. Yes, so it was...
Other whiskies are available.
Oh, absolutely so.
We should probably say that about the films as well. Other films are available to watch too.
Yeah, so that was filmed here. So this was made into a cooperage, this bit here. That was for an American commercial, but they filmed here.
We've come down to Mugdock Loch. There's a special status with regards to this loch, isn't there?
Yes, so the loch is triple SI, which is actually 70% of the park is, and that means it's a site of special scientific interest. so it's protected, so we don't allow any, you know, there's no fishing, there's no boats, there's no wild swimming, anything in here.
And we're joined by a swan right beside us. We're just keeping a close eye on it in case it gets protective over its cygnets if they're around, but it doesn't seem to be anywhere we are, thankfully. And also, Chris Pine was in this water.
Yes, he was.
He was allowed in.
He was allowed in, yet we made a small exception for him.
So you're liaising with these film companies or these productions to get things sorted for them here? You're sort of on the ground helping them as well, or are you needed much?
We're not really needed too much, to be honest. They're very self-sufficient. What will happen is it'll usually be a location scout, location manager, who'll get in touch with myself, and they'll come out and do a recce of the park, find out what areas they're interested in, and then we'll meet up and discuss it, or discuss it over the phone. And then from there, if they're wanting to go ahead, that's when we sort of look all more into the health and safety, the legalities of it all, and we'll sort of do all that. And then really, once they're on the ground, we just leave them to it. Afterwards, we'll sort of have a walk round to make sure that everything's been reinstated as it is.
And Mugdock is on a list of sort of sites, isn't it, for filming? You know, you're sort of recognised within the film industry as a site that can be used for productions.
Yes, we are. And a lot of it's word of mouth as well. I do attend a sort of locations network group through Creative Scotland and Screen Scotland, but a lot of it's word of mouth. So if somebody's been here before, or it might be a location scout speaks to another one and they'll tell them about Mugdock. There are a lot of people that come back that I've known over the years.
So we're just walking across one of your boardwalks here in the park. And I suppose these film companies, when they come here, the money that you get from that helps to pay for things here in the park, does it?
Yes, anything we get, any sort of fees from filming, go directly back into the park, whether it's for maintenance, development of new projects, it all comes back into Mugdock.
So it has to be ring-fenced for this? It doesn't go anywhere else?
No, it doesn't. No, it comes back in here.
Pam Grieve, the development officer with Mugdock Country Park there.
I haven't seen that film, Outlaw King.
Actually,
did we mention Outlaw King?
Outlaw King, yes, we mentioned it a few times. It was on Netflix. I don't know where you can get it, and other various streams are available too.
Brilliant casting. I mean, Chris Pine looks so Scottish.
His accent's good. It's passable.
Oh, all right, fair enough. Okay.
He's got a mullet as well, so he's quite on trend. It's all the rage now with the youngsters. Have you noticed that?
No, mullet? Not really. No,
have you noticed it? Anyway, time now to reveal our mystery sound for this week. Let's have a final listen.
No, I genuinely had no idea what this was, and I've been handed a list of correct answers, so I now know what it is. Kicking off with Neil Caldwell and Largs, who says, is today's mystery sound a metal detector?
Correct. Gary and Penny Cook, mystery sound and metal detector.
Now, Kat Lawson and Metallic says, usually I listen in bed. Today I'm getting up ready to drive south to join a mountain leader training course in Wales. The course starts on Monday. Last 6 days. I've checked the weather forecast. I'm taking every waterproof garment I own. Is the mystery sound a metal detector finding shrapnel in Dotheroff's jeans pocket?
Oh, that's very specific.
Do you think that's a dig about the fact that he leaves stuff in his pocket when it goes into the washing machine?
It sounds
I get that complaint a lot for some reason.
It's a tricky one, that. Yeah. People don't have money anymore anyway, do they? They all pay by contactless. Alistair and Nikki from Leaven, interesting show as always. Thank you very much. Is the mystery sound a metal detector?
Scott and Nadia Bothwell got it correct, saying they are half asleep listening from the comfort of Duvetland. Well, thank you very much for joining with the group, honestly.
Bertie and Gala Shields, yes, you're right, it's a metal detector.
And Anya McLean also got it correct, saying Detectorists by Mackenzie Crook, starring him and Toby Jones, an all-time favourite in the McLean household. It features this sound a lot. Well, I hope it is this sound. Have a super Saturday. All the best from Munster in Germany.
Stephen from Mulgay, a metal detector, correct. Uh-huh. And Kirsten from the West Midlands, a great programme as always, and yes, it is a metal detector.
I once interviewed a guy who's a ranger in the Blair Drummond Safari Park, and he got a metal detector for Christmas and sat in the box for about 3 weeks. He then took it out and found 3 gold torques. They were worth a fortune. That's it from us, I'm afraid. Don't forget our new Scotland Outdoors podcast available today at noon, and our midweek podcast on Wednesday, which features producer Helen Needham and I following in the footsteps of storyteller Stanley Robertson. Until the next time, from all the team here in Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.